Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Julia Gillard, and this is a podcast of one's own. I'm offended by the lack of women in positions of leadership and the way those that do make it are treated. Today, I help lead the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London, headquartered in the Virginia Woolf Building. In 1929, Virginia said she aspired for women authors to have the space to write in a room of one's own. Here, I want women leaders to have a podcast of one's own. My guest today is Asha Keddy, much awarded and much loved Australian actress. Asha, I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you, me too.
Good. Now, you are incredibly recognisable in Australia. When you walk down a city street, I'm sure almost every head turns to have a look and people whisper, oh, that's Asha Keddy. But you've said that you aren't really comfortable with the celebrity aspect of your work. Do you think that's different for women? The spotlight is different for women? What makes you feel less than comfortable about that kind of recognition?
I think perhaps when I was talking about the uncomfortability, it was when I had just begun to lose my anonymity. And that was quite a difficult thing. That was, you know, it was an unusual feeling. And although I had spent many years dreaming of being applauded for work and you know, recognised, and, you know, there's a part of every artist, I think, that wants to be and needs to be recognised and appreciated. Once it happened, I didn't quite know how to sit in it comfortably. I almost lamented it for a little while, I think. I think things have evolved now and I have become comfortable with it because it really is just part of life. I can't remember what it's like to walk down the street now and not be looked at. I can't remember that, really. It's been, quite a long time. And I'm more comfortable with it now, I think, also because I, you know, with age and experience, my confidence has grown, as my personal confidence has grown as well. So, you know, for someone that was playing roles and afforded the opportunity to play really wonderfully complex roles for many years without the recognition because of not being on a commercial show, for example, it was wonderful to have those 10, 15 years without recognition public recognition, I mean, the way it is now, to develop a strong sense of confidence and get some experience under my belt and find my voice, which took a really long time, I have to say. I think I was very much a late bloomer in that respect. So, yeah, you know, I'm comfortable with it now. I think it's okay. It just is what it is. I'm more protective of my children now, I suppose, and how they might feel if people stop us in the street or whatever.
Yes, have that recognition when you're out with your family. Mm. Do you think any of that experience is a gendered experience? Do you think a male actor who had the same steps in his career and then had the big public recognition sort of phase would have felt the same way or differently?
Quite possibly differently. I mean, you know, on top of recognition for your work on a show, as a female, you're also being looked at and judged by the way you dress, the way you do your hair, the way you stand on a red carpet, the way you put yourself out there in your image, the way your image manifests. I think that it is different for women. And certainly that was an element that I was extremely uncomfortable about. Don't get me wrong, I love fashion. I love dressing up. I love those moments where I do feel quite extroverted, but I'm not particularly interested in feeling judged like most people and for my appearance to be discussed on a level that I find really irritating, I guess. And I think, you know, this is an interesting thing that still happens. Not that long ago, I was made aware of an article that was written by one of those dreadful magazines that are still in circulation, in publication. I have no idea why. And the title of it was 18 Things You Didn't Know About Asha Keddie.
18.
And I thought,
not 10, not 20, 18.
No, 18. And I thought, that's kind of fascinating. Normally I wouldn't bother reading these sort of things. And I thought,
you might learn something.
I might learn something about myself. 18 things. How extraordinary. Do you know what I opened up to see? That it was, these were the kind of things that people didn't know about me, apparently. They were all mostly to do with appearance or to do with men. Things like, has Asha Keddie ever posed naked? Has Asha Keddie been married? Has she been divorced? Has she been pregnant? Is she pregnant? How many children does she have? Why is she a fashion icon? Why that? All these things. And I was reading it thinking, this is extraordinary. And I looked at the top and it was written by a woman. And it usually is. Now, that really gets me. And I think, why as a female journalist, and this happens often, do you want to spotlight things that I find completely irrelevant, but also to nurture a kind of a toxic culture of celebrity that personally I just think it's really outdated. It's really boring to read for a start, but it's so skewed towards appearance or being defined by a relationship or children or a man or, you know, I just find it fascinating that that kind of thing is still
there,
published
and still so much
and
at
bought.
The forefront.
Yes.
I'm going to take you to the words of a philosopher, Susan Sontag, who said, "The great advantage men have is that our culture allows two standards of male beauty, the boy and the man. The beauty of a boy resembles the beauty of a girl in both sexes. It is a fragile kind of beauty and flourishes naturally only in the early part of the life cycle. Happily, men are able to accept themselves under another standard of good looks, heavier, rougher, more thickly built. There is no equivalent of this second standard for women. The single standard of beauty for women dictates that they must go on having clear skin. Every wrinkle, every line, every grey hair is a defeat." Do those words ring true for how we treat women in the public spotlight, women in your profession, women in acting particularly?
Yes, I think so. But I also do feel the women that I admire and the women that I think are working prolifically in their 50s, 60s and 70s now are largely untouched by the pressure to remain youthful.
So they're not trying to look 20 or 30,
no,
they're just
that's
being
right.
themselves.
Yes, they're just being themselves. And certainly I am of that mind too. You know, I kind of personally like the way I look as I age. I like the way my friends look, my girlfriends. I like the way my sister does, my mother. And I particularly, I'm an actress. And so I think of actors when we're having this conversation. I think of Cate Blanchett and I think of Helen Mirren and Julianne Moore and these wonderfully gifted, driven, ambitious women who have great, strong voices who don't feel the need to inject themselves with goodness knows whatever you inject yourself with. They've got something different to say. And so they're the kind of people I admire, I guess, the kind of women I admire. And I certainly don't feel the pressure myself. But yes, I do agree that I think that it has just become part of our culture now too. I mean, I'm mortified when I see 20-year-old girls changing the shape of their faces or plumping their lips out and or their cheeks or whatever it is. So it's somehow become about more than just trying to hold on to youth. It's become about wanting to look like someone else, needing to have a different appearance to the one that you're born with.
Yes, I agree with you. There's something more going on than just get rid of that wrinkle. It's there's an increasingly standardised, even globalised view about what beauty is. And so if you can artificially get closer to that, then you try, or a lot of young women try.
Yeah, I think that's more of a concern to me than trying to remain youthful, that, you know, socially and culturally things are changing enormously and that's part of it. And the pressure of things being so visual now with Instagram, and there's so much imagery everywhere, and people need to, and filters for your photos, and, you know, people are wanting to achieve physical perfection, I suppose. I just didn't grow up like that. I didn't know what that really meant. I've always liked to look good. I have a very sophisticated, really stylish mother and aunts, and my grandmother certainly was. So I like to look great and feel great, but I don't want to look like someone else. I think things are changing now.
And you grew up doing ballet. That was your sort of first love, wasn't
it?
And then made
yeah.
the move into acting. And, of course, you burst into Australian popularity and public consciousness through Offspring, through playing Nina Proudman.
Mm.
And you won our Golden Logie, which is the highest accolade in Australia for those listening internationally. When that moment happened, you did lose your anonymity, and we've talked about that. What was the set of emotions? Was it, I've made it, I'm being recognised by the Australian community, or was that there the sense of a lot of women feel an imposter syndrome sense when they get to a moment of recognition? Some think, gee, this pedestal's way too high. What happens when I slip off it? What did you feel at that time?
I felt a little bit of both those things, if I'm really honest. And now with a different perspective and some distance from that time, I think there's certainly some truth in feeling like I was hoisted onto a pedestal and it was very, very high. The expectation was very high. Well, I felt it was. You know, and that was mildly uncomfortable. I thought, I'm not sure. I thought I wanted this, but do I? I felt like my freedom had kind of been thwarted a little, I suppose, and that I'd become someone in the public's eye that was, I guess, the golden girl, if you like. And I wasn't comfortable with that label, and it was certainly, you know, included in every headline over a few years. I wasn't comfortable with that label because I know who I am and I'm not a golden girl. You know, I have as many foibles and challenges and shortcomings as anybody else and struggles. And I didn't like the picture that was painted of me, I suppose. And I felt culpable in a way. And I thought, have I put myself out there like that? Perhaps because I'm very private and I don't give a lot away of myself, is this a picture that the public have had or the media have had to conjure and paint themselves, because I don't actually really let people know very much about me personally? You know, I had all those questions, I guess.
Can we just talk a little minute about that, what it's like to choose such a publicly exposed profession when clearly you are quite a private person?
That's right.
Most people would think people who go into acting, people who go into politics are natural extroverts who
yes.
want everybody to know everything about them. You
yes.
know, that's enough of you talking about me, I'll talk about me. You know, that kind
yeah,
of
right.
person who's insatiable to sort of expose everything to the public.
Yes.
But you are obviously a very private person
yes.
at heart. Did you think about that when you first embarked on the stage, the screen?
I don't think I thought about it. I found myself in that conundrum, I suppose. I felt like I landed in it when my profile became more public, I guess. You know, it's tricky because I think for a lot of creative people, a lot of artists, whether you're an actress, a painter, a writer, a director, a musician, you want... It's very contradictory. You want that appreciation that we touched on before. You want the approval. You want to be loved, you know, and there's certainly those elements in me. You want attention and you want your voice to resonate. But at the same time, in my opinion, to be an actor, for example, and deliver a story, you also need to be able to be in touch with and be able to channel very deep, intense feelings and emotions that are, for the most part, really private, and they come out on screen through the performance. So I guess for me, I have always, the drive to act, to perform and deliver a story has come from that place.
So that deep within.
That deep within place, the need to tell a story and for it to resonate and for it to be as relatable as possible. That's the drive for me. It's not so much the result, it's the process that is what I'm addicted to, I guess, and why I do it.
So you didn't set out to be famous, you set out to do this craft, this performance that
yes,
comes
because
from
I couldn't
deep within.
Not.
You couldn't not.
No. I mean, for want of a better way of saying putting it, I just couldn't not.
You couldn't imagine a different life?
No, I needed to tell stories. And, of course, that began as a young child, you know, just entertaining family and friends and being fairly extroverted, I guess. And then, you know, it morphed into quite a different, intensely private drive through my teenage years and certainly my 20s as well. And it wasn't really until I was about, 27, 28, I think I landed the role in Love My Way, that I was able to acknowledge myself that I could actually do this. I'd been given an extraordinary opportunity, an amazing character, very complex character to play on a groundbreaking series, really. And it wasn't till then, my late 20s, and I thought, oh, I've just had this intensely private journey for so many years, wanting to perform, wanting to have a big life and elevate myself, but not really knowing how. And then grasping that opportunity in my late 20s to, you know, find my voice as an actor and go for it.
Absolutely. Mm. And you've also woven that professional and public success with family life, with being married, with having a family. When you had your child, you actually took 2 years off.
Yeah,
and women are always interested in other women's balance and decision making. How did you think about putting together professional life and family life, particularly given in your world, I presume that if you're off the screen for too long, people start going, Asha who? Mm. So there's a real judgment call about how long to take off.
Sure.
How did you weigh all of that up?
You know, that was a really complex choice to make, the 2 years off. And you just touched on something really interesting. And I think that often it's seen that women, that they having to make a compromise if they take the time off work to have the child and raise it for the first year or, you know, have a long. I just didn't see it as a compromise. It was something I really wanted to spend that time enjoying and nurturing myself and my pregnancy. I really wanted that. It also coincided with a time where I was really exhausted.
Right.
I had worked very, very hard for probably 6 to 7 years at that point on back-to-back projects as the central female protagonist in the shows that I was making, like playing Ida Buttrose in Paper Giants, and then Nina in Offspring and so on. So I think the pregnancy coincided with a time where I really needed to take a break. And I also, it is complex that time actually, now I'm thinking about it and thinking out loud, I also felt like I was saturated and I thought, oh God, even I can't look at myself on another magazine cover. I was getting really tired of myself. I thought, surely it's time to step away for a moment and give everybody a break and give myself a break. And it was such a great choice to make. And then it was also wonderful to have a partner like Vincent who encouraged it. I mean, he just didn't for a second say, well, actually, question my choice about it. You know, he just said, well, you know, this is absolutely your choice. Whatever you want to do, however much, if you want to have 6 weeks off and go back, that'll be tough on you, but I'll pick up the slack or stop working for a while and I'll come look after Val. Or, you know, if you want to take 2 years off, then I think that's valid too. It's your choice. So he's really great and empowering me in that way to support my own choices. So it just felt like the right thing to do. And look, to tell you the truth, before I knew it, when he came, I just loved it so much, being with him. Before I knew it, it was 13, 14 months and before I went back to work, but it wasn't really a plan. It just happened that way.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And the work you've gone back to do, you're doing some amazing, gritty, raw roles that are really bringing to the public's attention some quite hard, confronting matters. Ooh. I've been watching The Hunting, which is a story about teenagers, in some ways teenagers being teenagers, but in today's world with the online environment. And it has a very up-close and personal look at these young people's lives and then how it reflects into the lives of the adults around them. I mean, the young actors in it are amazing.
Aren't they extraordinary?
Truly extraordinary.
Yeah.
And you've also done The Cry, which you've talked about and said was an incredibly emotional experience for you about a woman losing her children. Do you think about the power of drama to tell women's stories in particular? Is that what attracts you to things like The Cry, The Hunting?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the many gifts of Offspring was that Nina Proudman, you know, as kind of nutty and crazy and mad and clownish as she appeared to be in some ways, was an intensely complex woman to play. And one of the gifts of that show was that it was her point of view of the world. It was her, you know, it was one of the first shows here really that allowed a central female character to drive every part of the show, every choice that was made. So for me as an actor and as a woman, I have to say, a female performer and artist, I thought, I don't know that I can ever go back from here. This is driving something like this, ignited something in me that I like about myself, and that is that I am ambitious and I am driven to tell female skewed stories and reveal more about ourselves as women, so that perhaps it can have an impact culturally and socially. So certainly since I finished Offspring, the choices that I've made, I mean, that was one of the things that was great about having the 2 years off, is I had a lot of time to think too about really what I wanted to do next, really what kind of stories I wanted to tell. The Cry and The Hunting and now Stateless, I guess, it's been a combination of the right people around me, women, all women, and the right stories coming to my attention, but also my drive to support female-driven work behind the camera and in front of it too, for the protagonist to be female, or protagonists in the case of Stateless. So, you know, it's just, I couldn't be happier at the moment with the way things are evolving for me. But I also don't want to sit in the middle of it and think, oh, well, I've just been pulled along for the ride, because I do feel as if I have drawn these kind of projects towards me because, one, I want to explore them. Two, I think that there's bigger conversations to have rather than just sitting back, putting your feet up and watching a TV drama. And I'm kind of really only interested in working on projects like that now, where a bigger conversation can be ignited.
And can you just briefly describe Stateless, what it's about, and then for The Hunting, The Cry and Stateless, the main female connections there. For example, Anna Kokonos is the director of The Hunting,
Anna.
Fantastic director. And for The Cry, and maybe just a brief explanation of Stateless.
Sure. So Stateless is Kate Blanchett's production with Matchbox Pictures, written by Elise McCready, wonderful writer, and Belinda Jaco. And it looks at onshore detention. We won't say across a specific time. And it looks at onshore detention in such an unapologetic but very sensitive way as well. So there's four very distinct points of view that look at what onshore detention, the impact that it had on people's lives, albeit very different lives and positions in life. So it's difficult to talk about this project, and I will when it all comes together, and I really look forward to that being a bigger conversation too. Again, it's one of the most pressing issues of our time, and, you know, which leads me to The Hunting, which is again one of the most pressing issues of our time for teenagers navigating a very different world to the one we navigated when we were in our teenage years. I think that's a a really important thing to look at. I think it's really confronting. It's certainly confronting for me raising two boys at the moment. How am I raising them? You know, it looks at many things that we're all finding very difficult to talk about online exploitation, about toxic masculinity, about privacy and trust and, you know, these things that because we grew up with such hardwired ideas about men and women and what was appropriate. But we were getting to know each other and exploring sex and trust and friendship in a way that wasn't judged publicly the way it is now. I think as adults now, it's difficult to understand really just what they're navigating, teenagers these days. And I think The Hunting delicately explores that, but as it is confronting to watch. And I think, you know, teenagers and parents alike have a lot to learn from it. Adults alike have a lot to learn from it.
I feel like we're going to have a second conversation when we've
all
had the opportunity to watch all of The Hunting and Stateless has been released.
They're female-driven projects as well.
Which is fantastic.
Bonnie Elliott, an amazing cinematographer, arguably the most in-demand cinematographer in our country at the moment, shot The Hunting as well as Stateless. And female directors, Emma Freeman, I can talk about these people.
It's good we are talking about them because it's not the industry overall. And there's been a study released about the number of women who have worked on Australian filmmaking since the 1970s. So it's a retrospective, how many people got to tell us our stories during those decades. And it's found that only 16% of directors were women, only 23% of screenwriters, and only 30% of producers. Why is it like that? Why has it been like that? And how quickly do you think it's changing?
I think over the last few years, it's changing quite rapidly. And I think that's a result of the Me Too movement. I think it's a result of gender equality becoming a much bigger discussion in this country in terms of screen funding as well. You know, there's initiatives like Gender Matters that have made a huge difference there and continue to make a difference. I think it's frightening, isn't it, when you hear those statistics and you think, wow, that's incredible. But you see, my experience over the last 10 years has been one that's been quite different. I've had many women in leadership roles around me that have encouraged me to become a leader in my industry as well. So I think people's experience is different. I do think it's improving, though. I mean, certainly on Stateless, for example, I think it was 63% of the crew were female. So that's addressing the balance.
Yep, that's fantastic.
And I think very similar on The Hunting as well. So people are very conscious of making an effort now. Also, like, for example, Screen Australia, when they're funding projects, they're requiring for 50% to be of the crew and the creatives to be female, which is very, very helpful. And so I feel positive about and hopeful about those kind of initiatives, that they're going to stick and that we're going to encourage more women to participate. I also think, though, that it's perhaps these statistics that you've just read to me, is it wrong to acknowledge that perhaps women in the past, not so much in the last few years, in the past few decades, have not felt confident enough to back themselves and speak up about their ambition? You know, there's been times in my life, I think, where I've not felt enough confidence to back myself and say, well, actually, I've got some stories to tell and I've got some ideas and I'd like to be a producer. Will someone teach me? Will someone help me? There were times when I didn't have the confidence to do that, or I may have been crushed ever so slightly by someone's comment about that. And being a sensitive individual, you know, in a creative industry, I've made it a mountain as opposed to the molehill that it may have been. Do you know what I mean? And then I've lost confidence. So I think women's confidence is growing, certainly in my industry, and we're feeling we're feeling pretty strong at the moment.
And do you think the Me Too wave was part of unlocking that? What did you think when Me Too first started? Did you look at that and say, that's the industry I recognise, that's the way it's worked, or did it jar you in some ways?
It jarred me in some ways. My personal experience hasn't been one of harassment, I guess, over the years. Certainly I've experienced misogyny. Without going into specifics, because, you know, of course, there again is a dilemma for women, I think, speaking out about certain instances. If I were to do that, I would be facing lawsuits and my family would be in emotional danger and my, you know, yeah, it's very difficult to talk about these things. However, I can acknowledge and admit that certainly I've experienced misogyny and I have been I have felt very undermined at times. But yes, I think the Me Too movement, when that, because it was just such a, it enabled an outpouring, I guess, for women to tell their stories. And I think that's completely valid and must be supported. I think it allowed, again, what I'm interested in, a bigger conversation about issues of our time that are really important to discuss. I think we're getting braver about discussing difficult things, certainly that involve gender equality.
Yeah, I think Me Too has been an important part of that bravery.
Yeah.
On misogyny in the industry, and I understand you don't want to name names,
no.
But what form has that taken? Has it been about straight denial of opportunity? Has it been about aggressive personal treatment? Has it been sometimes these things can be masked in a almost bitter form of politeness rather than being straight in your face? So how would you summarise what it's been like?
I would say the latter is probably true in my case, and certainly something I'm starting to understand now is that misogyny or narcissism or anything like that I've experienced has come in a covert form. It's been much more covert than aggressive and outward, which has been possibly more painful and difficult to, well, rather confusing and difficult to understand.
And to point out.
And to point out, because this is the problem. If it's covert and it's cloaked in a polite way, it's so undermining that it's abusive. Whenever it's been happening to me, I've not known what's going on. And I think that may have personally to do with the way I was raised. I just didn't grow up thinking there was ever boundaries with gender that I should be aware of. My mother was a great feminist and still is. And she allowed me to do and believe what I wanted. She gave me good, strong boundaries, and it was important to her that I maintained dignity and that I was respectful to other people and to myself. And, you know, but I also felt enormous freedom to do what I wanted to do. I never felt constricted. So I think I almost feel like there was a naivety involved as I grew up and hit my 20s and certainly my 30s when I started to gain some recognition for my own work. And then my ambitions started to grow and I thought, oh, I might quite like to reach out and diversify and explore different creative paths. I didn't know at the time that actually I was being subtly undermined by certain people. Or that I was being manipulated to think that perhaps I should just stick to what I know.
Mm. Be a good girl.
And I'm be a good girl. Don't make too much of a ruckus, you know. And at the time I felt I lost some confidence around that. And I thought perhaps that's what I should do. I certainly don't think that now. I've learned from that, I guess, that as covert as it was, and whatever agenda was there for anyone doing that to me, I'm really kind of really disinterested in it. It doesn't touch the sides with me anymore. I just, you know, I've kind of come, I almost feel like I've come full circle as a 45-year-old woman back to that little girl that my mother was raising, letting me run down the street in her exquisite, long-trained wedding dress because I felt like it and I wanted to express myself. I almost feel like I've come full circle to that little girl who believed that anything was really possible and that I didn't have to ask permission to do things, you know, or make choices.
That's a beautiful image. I love it. I love it. Now, we have a series of standard questions for the end of each podcast. We always try and find a fun fact, but in reality, most of the facts we find are unfun. And this is an unfun fact. Of the top 100 grossing films of 2018, women represented 4% of directors, 15% of writers, 3% of cinematographers, 18% of producers, 18% of executive producers, and 14% of editors. When are we going to hit it so that's 50% right down that column?
Wow, that is that's dismal, isn't it? That's unfun.
That's unfun.
Look, I'm going to speak positively to this because I think it's important to recognise, certainly around me, there are trailblazers. They are coming. I want to be a part of that push where we reach 50%. I think we're getting there. I really do. And I think women's confidence is growing enormously in my industry.
Good. If you got that gold Logie at home and rubbed it and a magic genie came out and made you boss of the world for a day... Boss of the world, what would you change for women?
Oh, wow. I find this is a really difficult thing to think about. I can't name one thing, I don't think. It's more a sense of something. I think I would, and I can only speak to my own experience, my own emotions, I guess. If I could change anything, I would change the level of confidence that women feel about themselves from day dot, from being little girls. And I hope that things are changing for little girls now so they don't have so much to push against the way you and I have.
Yes, and that they hold that confidence.
And that they hold that confidence. Yeah.
As they grow. Now, Virginia Woolf says... I will not be famous, great. I will go on adventuring, changing, opening my mind and my eyes, refusing to be stamped and stereotyped. The thing is to free oneself, to let it find its dimensions, not to be impeded. Asher says...
This has been the story of my life, as an actor and as a woman, I think. That resonates with me so strongly. As an actor, it resonates strongly. Their journey, the process is what ignites me and engages me. And certainly that's true of my life personally as well.
Asher, we're looking forward to seeing much more of you and the stories you're telling from that deep place on screen. It's been fantastic to talk to you today.
Oh, thanks, Julia. Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of One's Own with Julia Gillard from the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London. For more information on our work and to sign up to our updates, visit the Global Institute for Women's Leadership website. This podcast has been produced by Lizzie Ellen and James Miller with King's Online and additional editing by Nick Hilton. If you've liked what you've been listening to, please rate and review us with your preferred podcast provider. And come back next time for another episode of A Podcast of One's Own with Julia Gillard.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.